Welcome to The Cutting Edge, a podcast from the U.S. Army Combat Capabilities Development Command, known as DEFCOM. I'm Dr. Eric Moore, and it's my honor to host this special episode featuring Dr. Patrick Baker. Dr. Baker has been the director of DEFCOM Army Research Laboratory for more than 5 years, and he will soon retire after a remarkable career as an Army civilian, starting 40 years ago as a student trainee. Yep. Pat, welcome today. It's good to have you.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. I appreciate you doing this on podcast too, because you know they say, you know, when you have a face for radio. Unfortunately, I don't really have a voice for radio either. So we'll see how it goes.
You got a great voice for radio, Pat. And you know, you've been a cornerstone of innovation and progress in Army research, and your contributions have left an indelible mark on the field. So today, I'd like to explore your journey and the legacy that you're leaving with us. So, Pat, throughout your career, you've worked at DEFCOM Army Research Laboratory at every level, supporting its mission to operationalize science for the Army. Could you explain what it means to operationalize science and why this mission is so critical?
Well, the short answer is no, I can't explain operationalizing science, but just let me start off up front. So, yeah, thanks again for hosting me, and thanks for your kind words. You've been very fortunate. You mentioned 41 years, I guess. You've had great teammates all along the way, and it's been fabulous. And one of the greatest things about the Army is the people. You know, the people we meet along the way from so many different places. You know, you got, you know, a DEFCOM and RDCOM and ARL, but you know, the PMs that you meet, the industry partners you meet, the academic partners you meet, you know, other agencies we work with, and of course the soldiers. You know, absolutely fabulous. And so I just wanted to kind of say that up front. But you know, back to operationalizing science, no, you can't explain it. It's easy to say, it's hard to explain, it's, you know, impossible to, you know, specify. You know, I guess a little context about operationalizing science, you know, we're in a much different world than we were 40-some years ago. Yes, you know, I look back and I say, you know, what were we doing 41 years ago? Well, in some ways, we were operationalizing science. Matter of fact, we've always been operationalizing science. You know, you think back to 1984 when I started my career, back to 1944, right? You know, another 40 years before that, you know, we were operationalizing science in World War II. I mean, I think we all know that, right? Mm-hmm. Radar, atomic bomb, so forth. You know, but today the context is so much different. You know, we are in a pitted competition, you know, against our major adversary to, you know, turn science, you know, science and technology into something useful for our soldiers. Right. And, you know, we have to win. So it's a competition. We have to win. So we say win the competition, operationalizing science, you know, at ARL. You know, failure's, you know, not an option. I figured you would ask me this. So I actually did bring with me, right, you know, the you know, what I'll call a attempt at a definition. But, you know, it's basically, you know, it's a team act of purposely partnering, you know, across our, you know, our value system, right, to deliver to the Army some fundamentally advantageous change, right? And it's a change that's rooted in, you know, the creation and the exploitation of scientific knowledge. Ultimately, you know, though, we have to deliver at the speed of relevance, which is at the end of that definition. You know, so, you know, it's really important. So there's a lot in that one sentence, right, that you can, you know, that you can unpack. But, you know, team is up at the front, you know, deliver is at the tail end. And then, you know, in the middle, you talk about the uniqueness of the science, the uniqueness of what we do, right? You know, and it's not just science, it's science and technology, right? And the partnering, right? The importance of partnering, you know, because there is, you know, I, you know, maybe get into it a little bit more, but, you know, there is no, you know, one way, you know, of doing it. One thing I will say, because, you know, people think science and they tend to think very narrowly, but it's science, but it's, you know, it's, that's an abbreviation for science, the scientist, the scientific institutions,
right,
the scientific ecosystem, those industry partners we have, which rely on, you know, some leap ahead technology or science, right? You know, so it's, you know, it's all of that. And then, you know, bringing it together through some really key, you know, partnerships to ultimately, you know, deliver something on time. And that's why, you know, when we came up with this years ago in ARL, and we said, well, what do we do? What do we do? And, you know, ultimately, you know, came to this short sentence, and the operationalized was right up front. Because even the things we do that are real far out, you know, we've got a sight vision, a sight picture, which has delivering something at the end, even if you don't know what it is when you start.
You know, I'm glad you said that because, you know, I used to manage, as you're fully aware, basic research when I was at the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. And I think I've shared with you, I've had two really hard jobs as a civilian. The most obvious is directing the Kim Biles Center, where folks are working with some of the most dangerous pathogens and chemicals known to man. Oftentimes, we don't even have medical countermeasures for those. But we have engineering controls, and we have smart people, who've professionals who know how to do the work. And so that gives you some comfort. But managing basic research was the hardest job I've ever had. You know, it's, you know, by definition, basic research, 6-1 research is supposed to be unaligned. So on the DITRA side, when I'd brief it, they say, Moore, your basic research is too applied. I'd go over to the Joint Chem Biodefense Program during POM reviews and brief basic research, and they'd say, it's not applied enough, it's too unaligned. And so I would brief what I called 6.61.5.
Right.
And so you're always bridging that gap. So from your perspective, and I think operationalizing science gets us in that space, you know, but it's a challenge to make people see the relevance and the importance of this science. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, seeing the relevance from basic research, you know, you can use some examples.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's kind of three main ways that we deliver. I say we, the community delivers. You know, first, I think it's sort of what I'll call that traditional way that maybe you think about it,
yeah.
And that you create a new opportunity, right? And, you know, some examples. I mean, I'll tell you, we started thinking about autonomy decades ago,
right?
You know, seriously thinking about autonomy decades ago, making investments in basic research. There's an example we use is we had a single university professor program that we were investing in. You know, said, you know, hey, you can come up with this path integral and autonomous systems can do it. And, well, we had no idea. But it paid off, and then we turned it into a bigger basic research program. And then ultimately, you know, that with some other work went into a collaborative research alliance, and you started seeing companies start to spin out, things like that. And lo and behold, today, right, a lot of the autonomy and, more advanced robotics, let's say, that we use, relies on some of that, approach, but also more importantly, those companies that have spun out, right? So some of the companies today are companies, created by professors and investments that we made, decades ago, and now we're reaping the benefits of that. So there's all those sort of looking back, examples of what we've done with 6.1. But then you look at kind of the second way you operationalize science, which is what I'll call kind of you have your known unknowns, right? Mm-hmm. Where you say, hey, here's a threat, or here's a gap, or an objective or a threshold, and you have to rely on the science that's been created, the technology that's been created, and you advance the technology, right? So things with next gen squad weapon, right? Army's got great lethality. Well, that's because we invested in the understanding of the ballistics, the materials, how you measure, projectiles moving fast, and the yaw and all that. So we invested in that and in the people that were able to do that. That's sort of your directed, if you will, transformation. Same thing with some things we're doing today, transitioning things to the PNT community, right? Mm-hmm. Anti-jam antennas and things like that. Well, that's, it's because we made an investment in the technology and in the facilities and so forth. And I think the last thing is, and it does all connect together, is, the things when we have to, I like to call it the readiness to operationalize in science, but it's that emerging threat, right? And, you were there, you understand what we did, and, the whole community,
right?
And, Iraq and Afghanistan, when the threats were coming out, and you see it today. There's things going on in the theater and, across DEVCOM, within ARL, we're taking, early TRL expertise with the experts, and we're spinning stuff out and producing it. So it's those three things that have sort of always been there, in terms of, opportunity driven, sort of gap or threat driven, and then the emerging need driven. And I, one of the things I like about that is it fits really well with where we are today as an Army with continuous transformation. As you look at, obviously our number one goal in ARL is the concept required capabilities, but then you still have, these known unknowns where we're linked with the centers, we're linked with industry, and we're going after, these specific systems, right, where you actually know what you're going after. And then the TIC units, right? I mean, I think we've done really well, linking, DEVCOM with the TIC units and other units as well, so, yeah.
And you use some terms to go back to one of our former secretaries, and we start talking about known unknowns, unknown unknowns, kind of that unknown unknown space. as a young second lieutenant, commissioned, I won't say when, but I was 1987. I'm not ashamed of that. And so in 1987, I had no concept that we'd be looking at a battlefield that has drones and robotics and autonomy. I mean, and if you really think about it, my grandfather served in World War II. My father was during the Vietnam era in the Air Force. And the weapons and capabilities we had, they were different. There was more technology, but it wasn't that far from what we had seen before. You know, gas masks looked like gas masks right. from World War I for the most part. Tanks looked like tanks-ish. The capabilities are much stronger. But when you start looking at some of the new developments and technologies, one that we've worked on together with a bit, so you were doing gene editing technologies for a long time. Then CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing technologies come about, which revolutionizes that space. And now you've got a whole team of people that are doing synthetic biology. In my world, we were looking at threats and looking at ways to have countermeasures against those threats. But in your world, you're doing a lot of work that's now being scaled up into biomanufacturing, to ruggedize weapons, to make some of the thermal properties stronger for some of our equipment, et cetera. As you look at all these technologies and whatnot, what has kind of really been the most exciting to you? I mean, there's a lot of developments, but for you personally, what is might just be based on your own personal interests.
Yeah, well, from a technology point of view, of course, as the ARL director, I don't have a favorite.
You love all your children.
I love all of my children, right? But well, in all seriousness, because...
But what surprised you? Has any breakthrough come out that really just surprised you?
Not that we can probably talk about in this setting.
I got you.
But I think what I would say is I'm very impressed, actually, you mentioned the bio community, right? With how fast we're able to turn things now. So, of course, I personally wasn't doing any CRISPR-Cas9 stuff. But, you know, if you look at what we've done in SynBio, right, because we've been able to put the partnerships together, you know, with the academic community all around the country, with, you know, some of the, you know, the great industries we have out there, we've been able to turn things from, like, basic research to where we're out, you know, in, you know, Army official experimentation, looking at what can we sense and so forth, from 6-1 to experimentation in a matter of a few years, right? And getting that soldier feedback. And to me, that I guess it's not surprising because I've always seen the greatness in ARL and then, you know, DEVCOM and their soldiers, but, you know, just how fast it moves, it's impressive. It's the same thing in the AI space, you know, these days as well. So you set up these academic partnerships and you're able to get feedback from the soldiers and shape your program at a much faster pace than you ever could. You know, in the past, that's been to me really impressive, and I think really sets us up well for where we're headed in the future. You know, as a command, and of course, bio is just one of many, many examples of what, you know, what we do in the command. So
that's awesome. And you know, we've had many debates most of the time on a Friday, seems like, Pat.
Yeah,
and it seems like sometimes we leave feeling good. We always, as brothers, we always come together at the end. Sometimes we have some pretty knock down, drag out over the years, and I've always enjoyed it because you've pushed me to think about some things differently, and hopefully I've done the same with you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But, you know, ARL is recognized for pushing boundaries in pursuit of new ideas. Can you discuss a disruptive innovation or research program and explain how it has helped or will help drive the Army's continuous transformation?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, I think there's two things. I'll talk a little bit about maybe some tech, but maybe also about the approach, because I think it's both, right? So to disrupt, you know, having the technology is one thing, but how you actually do that operationalization, if you will, for that
right.
word, hard to say, you know, is another thing. So we've not only the tech, but we've changed the business model. So I think, you know, where we are kind of in the autonomy AI space, right? You know, think about how we started, but now we're like working with some major industries, I think, you know, as you're tracking, you know, at the same time we're working with, you know, the academic community, but then also we're looking at, I'll say, Army unique data.
Yes.
Right? Which I think is really key to operationalizing science, is you get after the phenomena that are Army unique. You know, so that's just, you know, one example, and I think you can sort of tell the same story, you know, in electronic warfare, you know, in bio. I think microelectronics, I'm really thrilled about that.
Me too.
You know, if you look back at kind of where we were, you know, what we did with, you know, silicon carbide, what we did with GaN, you know, and so forth, and how it revolutionized. I think we're heading off in the same direction, you know, today with some new technologies and, you know, working very tightly, you know, which I don't think people realize because there's so much going on under the hood at DevCom, right? Working very tightly with fabs, working you know, very tightly with industry. And, you know, it's, you know, you got to actually, you know, have the software, you got to have the fabs, but, you know, we've got these unique facilities and we got this expertise. So I think microelectronics is going to be big. But to me, the most disruptive thing is the way that, you know, since we've stood up AFC and now going into T2Com, that, you know, S&T is working directly with the soldiers.
I agree.
Because you look at the complexity, and we have this phrase that we use in ARL, which is, you know, hey, you got to collide science with operational complexity and commercial innovation. And we've really collided that science with the operational complexity. Because if you look at, like, how we used to fight air-land battle, I mean, you know this because, you know, we're the same era, right? Very linear. And you could, you know, predict, you know, from what you're doing in the lab, you could sort of spell it out using your engineering and scientific principles all the way up through some loss exchange ratio that you would see in Europe, right? You know, try to do that with the complexity and the pace of change today and in the future battlefield. You can't, right? So you could, if you don't collide science with operational complexity, right? If you don't bring those scientists and those scientific institutions, right? You know, even the academic community, right? And put them together with the soldiers, you know, and the experimentation and the learning, you're going to potentially be, you know, driving the left field when the Army needs you to go to right field, right? So I think that's been very exciting, what we've done with experimentation, all the way from shaping the concept, right, to working with, you know, the CDIS, to working with the experimentation, to now working with the units, right, directly in the field. I think that's going to give us, you know, a disruptive, since we like that word, but a disruptive advantage, you know, over our adversaries.
I agree. And it's kind of interesting because I think in the future, we're going to see technology's going to, obviously, we talk about Moore's Law all the time, but technology's going to outpace our ability to keep up with the technology. And so we need to actually have a way to reach out to soldiers and understand tools that they have that we need to kind of work on and make them more military applied. So right now, for instance, you know, we talk about how just a cell phone in Afghanistan or something, and it replaced many, many things. Obviously, cameras, obviously ways to communicate. Now, there were some things that we saw we didn't necessarily like, obviously, because you always got to worry about electronic signatures and stuff like that. But I'm just using that as an example. But there's likely going to be a technology in the future that everyone's going to have access to that from a program of record perspective, maybe we didn't work on, but it's going to be a game changer. Soldiers are going to take it, innovate on it, and we're probably going to need to catch it and figure out how to do something with it technologically as well.
Absolutely. And I think, well, you start to lean, so it's, you know, we weren't thinking about it, so that means it probably came in the industry somewhere, right? And I think, to me, that's one of the other great things. It's not just the, you know, the operational complexity. It's colliding, you know, with commercial innovation as well. And I think, you know, that's something I think we've always been doing. You know, we've got hundreds of creators, and, you know, we engage with industry at, you know, kind of not just the big boys, so to speak, but, you know, the main primes, but also the subs all throughout the supply chain.
That's right.
And I think, you know, that's something that we do and it's something we need to continue to do. And we need to innovate in terms of how we do that as well. And I think we have through some of the innovation programs, you know, that we do. I think it'd be good if maybe we advertise that a little more because, you know, I think that is a key thing, a key part of, you know, what we do.
So to advertise, and I'm going to give you some kudos, but you sit on a number. I don't think a lot of folks realize the number of different boards and things that you sit on as the ARL director. I know in the case of BioShield and some of the biomanufacturing initiatives, you actually represented the Army with industry in that space, didn't you?
Well, for a little bit, and for a little bit, BioMade, it was a very short thing until, frankly, got overwhelmed. So I turned that responsibility over to people who, you know, we have a lot of good leaders and turned over to somebody else who knew more about bio. But yeah, absolutely, in that space. And of course, we've got some other great folks, you know, STs, you know, throughout DevCom who also are heavily involved, you know, in that area as well.
That's awesome. So the other thing, so you've kind of led me to my next question. So collaborative partnerships with academia, industry, and government agencies are central to DEFCON ARL's mission. Which partnerships have stood out as examples of accelerating science-enabled capabilities for the Army?
Yeah, well, so I think I already hit on it. Kind of the, you started with the trifecta. You start with the trifecta, right? Industry, government, academia, right? We've been talking that for decades, right? And then you go to, you know, what I'll call, you know, the superfecta, right? For those people who, you know, bet on horses, which I don't. But, you know, that's when you sort of add.
You never have.
Right.
Going on
I think a couple times in high school I went to the Preakness. And, you know, But then, you know, so you have the superfecta, right? You add the units in there as well. And then sometimes you add a fifth, which is, you know, the IC, but let's call the, you know, the intelligence community, the people that give us the threat info, mm-hmm. right? We can, let's call them, you know, another government agency. But to me, it's that combination and then the way you weave it together. You know, so I guess you know, we could talk about specific partnerships, right? I mean, we could go back to things we've done with Armor or things we've done with, you know, some of the sensing in Iraq and some of the things we've done that we talked about in bio where we've put multiple, you know, you put the, you know, the small bio company with the large sort of end, end item maker, right? You put that partnership together. You know, so we do that, you know, kind of on a regular basis, and I think it's real important. But again, I think the difference now is the great involvements with the units. And then also I think more and more, you know, with industry. I do think we have to be careful, though, because I think, you know, we are at risk sometimes of oversimplifying things.
Yes, right?
And
I
you
agree.
Say, well, hey, you know, they're spending, you know, $1 billion here and we're spending $10 million here. Maybe we should get out of the business, right? Because clearly they're going to drive it. I mean, look at all this stuff. I mean, if that was the case, we'd get out of the gun business, right? Because, you know, there's a lot more guns being bought in the private sector than than there is in the Army, right? Mm-hmm. But we don't because, you know, we know the importance of it and the importance that, you know, we're very good at it and we have to, you know, link the technology to how we use it in the Army. So I think we need to be careful that we don't just make simple decisions and change our research program, you know, sort of based on, you know, the macro view, all right? It's important. And people at DEVCOM, I think, where you get that, you know, that knowledge of, hey, they may be spending a lot, and that may mean that we need to spend less, but they may be spending a lot, and we may need to spend more so that we can innovate faster and provide that protected advantage, that protected capability when we're using it versus our adversaries, because everybody's going to have access to most of this technology. So, you know, what we bring, right, what our experts bring within DEVCOM and within ARL, right, is, you know, the ability to turn it into something that's more advantageous than our adversaries.
You know, I'm glad you said that. So, you know, I just came back from that UNC lead tier two.
You have some good food down there? I know they feed you well in North Carolina.
Man, I'll be fasting for the next month trying to get all this extra stuff around my midsection. But the point is, really, while at that course, we talked a lot about innovation and stats that everybody knows. I mean, if you just look at industry and the hotel industries versus Airbnb, if you go to the airport, right, you see Uber and Lyft everywhere, and you see the taxi drivers seem like they're struggling to get people to take a taxi these days. And there have been many kind of things that happen in society in other areas, whether you're talking Polaroid, Kodak, et cetera, in terms of cameras. But we talked a lot about this SCS model for innovation and basically what you're going to stop doing, what are you going to change that you're doing, and then, of course, what are you going to start doing that you haven't been doing.
Right.
But I guess the thing that gets me when I think about industry and the plight of Fortune 500 companies that don't exist as long as they traditionally did, what is disruptive in that space for industry where something that was being planned seems like it was going to, you know, be a winning horse at the end? You talked about, you know, the horse racing and men's whatnot. So from that perspective, you know, that's always a gamble we're making. How do we ensure, really, that we're aligning ourselves, predicting the future as best we can, and having a broad array of technologies and things that we're investing in so that we don't put all of our horses in one basket and it fizzles out at the end?
Yeah. No, hey, you know, great question. I'm going to sound a little bit like a broken record here.
It's okay.
But let me say up front, though, is we do need to focus, right? I mean, things are different. You know, our money bucket, right, is not as much of a greater size compared to others as it used to be. Access to technology, right, is different. You know, so we need to focus on the most important things, right? Not just cover the whole waterfront.
Yeah.
However, I think the way we do that and we win is again through integration, right? You know, as we go into T2COM, we build on what we've done within ASC, which is, you know, integrate science and technology, you know, with, you know, where we are with the concept, you know, and the CRCs and, you know, the warfighters telling us what they need, you know, integrate that better, right? You know, build on this teamwork we've done between, you know, the active units, you know, the S&T, you know, the commercial innovation, you know, that will allow us to focus, right? To get after what we're going after. So I think, it, you know, if we keep this up and we double down on it, you know, maybe there's a capability that we need, you know, or an area of capability that we need, right? So, you know, the acquisition community, the requirements developers, you know, all the way back to the centers and S&T, you know, we need to, you know, team together to get after that, getting the feedback from the soldiers, you know, sort of along the way. But here's the thing, mm-hmm. right? Things are going to change. You're going to learn things, right? The threat's going to evolve, right? The, you know, technology is not going to advance on an equal scale, and it's going to advance at an unpredictable scale in some ways, right? So we need to make sure we maintain, you know, the autonomy, you know, at our S&T level that we can help, you know, the acquisition community when, you know, they need more in one area and maybe can scale back a little bit, you know, in another area. So somehow, as I think as an Army and, you know, feeding back to us in the S&T community, we have to maintain. We have to integrate, but then we also have to say, well, okay, how do we maintain the right level of autonomy and then feeding the information back to sort of help decision processes at all echelon? I mean, I know it sounds kind of vague, but I think we're actually getting there as we set up T2COM and, you know, heading in that direction. I mean, that's my sense from, I'll say, more or less the inside outside where we are. We don't know everything.
You know, this is funny because I had one of your employees with me earlier today who's in the Distinguished Leaders Program, yeah. Dr. Michael Frame. We had a conversation about the fact that just because you have the best technology doesn't mean you're going to necessarily win the battle. Right. So there's always the warrior ethos, the human being, the person behind it. Right. I use an example of Italy and fighting against the Ethiopians, and they definitely had more technology, better equipment and whatnot. They didn't necessarily win and defeat the Ethiopians. And so the question is, for us, it's always, our soldiers, our NCOs, our people, at the end of the day, it's people that fight battles and win wars. We always right. want to have the most equipped, most technologically sound Absolutely. Army ever. But we also have to make sure that our people yeah. are apprised of use of these tools. So you've done a lot in terms of having work with soldiers, ensuring, and I realize with T2 Command, you know, the whole training piece right. is going to be there as well, but you've been doing some work throughout, working with some of the units and soldiers, everything from Catalyst Pathfinder yep. and others. Yep. So anything in that space you want to talk about? Because it's always defaults to the soldier, and you've talked a lot about the soldier here.
Yeah.
Some of the initiatives that you've done.
Sure. Well, I mean, a couple things from like an ARL and the, you know, perspective. I think, you know, we show this chart sometimes about here's how we interact with the soldier, and you're right. I mean, it's varied, right? It's everything from, you know, Catalyst Pathfinder, you know, which, you know, we basically, you know, DevCom, right? ARL helping DevCom. You know, we're working with the units, and, you know, the great Catalyst Pathfinder team has set up software so we can get input directly from soldiers, and then you connect, you know, that with a, you know, local academic partner and some business partners, right? And, you know, where it's appropriate, we're spinning it back into a DevCom program, or we're spinning it right out to some, you know, to an industry partner. So that, you know, so on one extreme, you're working directly right there with the units. But then something that I find really exciting, right, is our relationship with, like, the military academy mm-hmm. and the senior military colleges, because that's, you know, you're looking at, like, future Army leaders there, and it's very important that they understand the value of S&T, because how many times in our career, right, has somebody come to DevCom or, you know,
been assigned to DevCom?
What's a DevCom?
What's a DevCom?
What's an ARL? Right? So I think, you know, one of the things that I always find exciting is to get involved with the military academy and get involved with the senior military colleges. And you see these, you know, young folks, right, compared to me and you. And
speak for yourself, buddy.
All right. Well, you're right. You're only as young as you feel, right? And I can tell you, when I try to keep up with them, I don't feel as young as I still.
No. You can't. You definitely can't run two miles.
But I'll tell you, you're working with the military academies, right? Yeah, and then it's not just that, it's also the cadet command, right? Right. You know, we had 40-ish, you know, ROTC cadets from all over the country in the lab this summer, you know, and it gives them a flavor, and, you know, the professionalism of these young people and this intelligence, you know, it's just fabulous, and it makes you feel good, you know, about the future, you know, the future of the Army. And then you extend it out to, you know, not just what we're doing, you know, on the military side, but, you know, we had our student symposium here, you know, right here at APG in Mallette the other day with like 100 and some, you know, students, right, high school up through, you know, I guess postdoc, you're technically not a student anymore. and you just look at what they're doing, it's great. And the, you know, and look, we're going through some challenging times with our hiring these mm-hmm. days, but you know, still able to bring, you know, the students in this summer, right? It was just, you know, fabulous, right? Of course, they're not government employees, but
they will be one day.
They will be. Well, some of them will. And see, that's the mm-hmm. other thing is, you know, you look at what we do with the academic community out there, and right, we can't hire everybody. We never could, right? But, you know, we're making investments that is feeding in to national security, right? That's right. So not only do you get the great research, and we can talk about that, but you also get, you know, the investment, right, in, you know, national security through all the, I'm a product. I think, you know, I don't know if you, I can't remember whether you were funded by the Army.
I was funded. I was given a scholarship specifically for biochemistry. My ROTC scholarship
there you
was
go.
For biochemistry.
There you go. Yeah. Right. Right. So, you know, so both of us, right. A product of, you know, Army investing in, you know, the future. Right. I mean, you know, if you're in an industry, right, you got to make a profit. You got to put things out. Right. But you also have to think about investing in the future, right? And when we invest in these universities, right? When we invest in these, you know, ROTC students, when we invest in the military academy, I mean, that's the future.
It's true.
I mean,
it's true.
And you think back to, you know, we talk about a 40-some year career, right? I think you mentioned like a 1987 or something.
Yeah,
right?
Something
the second
like
lieutenant.
That. Right? I went to basic training in 85, though.
Right, a basic training in 85, right? So, you know, I showed up here in 84, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, these investments have, you know, well, certainly in your case, it's had a long-term impact. I won't speak for myself, but I see it around ARL all over. You know, these people, you know, people have to remember, you know, you can think about like a 2 or 3 year cycle for a job, but, you know, these people are building capability, you know, over and knowledge that pays off, you know. So when times get tough, it's really important that we know something, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so you got to be careful not to, you know, sort of lose that.
It is important, and you've done a lot in this space over the time. I could go on and on in terms of things you've done in terms of tech transfer, tech transition. I mean, I'm a fan of ARL, and you've done an outstanding job. I'd love to even go back to your days with SLAD and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah,
but we don't have time for
oh,
that.
Come on.
we kind of keep the podcast shorter than 2 hours or something.
All right.
But as ARL pushes the boundaries of scientific discovery, what is your vision for the future of Army research?
Yeah. I think I've talked about the vision already, right? I mean, I think it's really, you know, to integrate, right? You know, to learn, you know, to prioritize, you know, make sure we're investing, right, in the future. I think that's it. I mean, we're going to continue to explore, right? But in the end, we're always going to be thinking about leap aheads. You know, I will say one thing. We've tried to change, you know, the dynamic, right?
Right.
You know, we used to have this thing that said fail fast, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't believe in failure. There's no such thing as failure, right? There's only winning.
It's only winning.
Every failure is a learning opportunity.
Tell the nigga nights. Shake
That's
and
right,
bake, baby.
Man, shake and bake, right? Every failure is a learning opportunity. And I don't believe in, you know, risk either, right? It's not, you know, risk, high, you know, we used to say high risk, high reward, mm-hmm. right? Well, if something's high reward, take that high risk and mitigate it. And you do that through teaming and integrating, right, and stuff. So, you know, it's not about high risk, high reward. It's about high reward.
That's right.
And then figure out how to get there. So, yeah, you know, I guess that's the vision. And I tell you, look, I mean, I think you mentioned I'm retiring or, you know, I'm retiring, you know, before T2 Command or just when T2 Command goes. I'm excited about T2. I mean, to me, I see, you know, a vision of, you know, integration, everything from, you know, an end capability, you know, to the science. We just gotta, I think, be careful as leaders, right? You know, that you recognize how complex it is, mm-hmm. right, to go from research to operations, you know, so that we don't sort of, you know, think about like, hey, I'm not getting my meal fast enough and I don't like what I'm eating, therefore, you know, I gotta like stop farming on the front end, right?
That's right.
Well, you're still gonna need food. Right, we just got to think about how do we integrate and make sure we have a well-defined menu and know how much we want to what, and then you work it as a team of the whole supply chain. You know, so but it's not food; it's, you know, it's research both in industry and academia, right, to capability, and it's not just them. As you know, you talked earlier, right? It's the whole .mil PF, which is one of the great things.
You stole it from me. I was about to say that. Exactly, it's not just them; it is throughout the total .mil
right.
PFP. So you mentioned T2 Command. So which areas of science and technology do you see as most critical for Army's continuous transformation in the coming decade, especially as we move into T2 Command?
You know, you're trying to pin me down.
It's like
walking
right?
in and saying, well, who's your favorite child, right? And things like that. I mean, it's those that
it's
are
not
going to
be one thing.
Right.
It's systems and,
right.
and different.
Right.
I know
right.
that.
Right. I mean, and, you know, we're going to cut back on some competencies here. We're going to, you know, emphasize there. You know, but it really gets down to the capability and then, you know, what areas of science and technology give you that advanced capability. But we always have to be exploring. I'd say, you know, yeah, it's interesting. We had some breakthroughs this in the last couple of years in the area. And I'll give you my clocks and rocks story, right? Sorry if I'm taking too much time here, but
no,
clocks
you're good,
and rocks,
man.
Right? So, right. So we made an investment in another single investigator program, right? Looking at some you know, isomer, nuclear isomer, right? Tickling nucleus with a laser, able to get a transition. And, you know, people know a lot more about this than I do, but hey, we can come up with like a whole new timing capability. This could going to be a leap ahead. It's going to take a while to make it happen and, you know, fundamentally give us some advantages. You know, so those kind of things are going to go on, right? We're still going to explore, you know, in that regard. And by the way, what the team did, they went out and they got some customers to make some basic research investments with us, right? So that's the other thing you got to realize, right? I mean, we got people out there who are like working to bring other people's money, right, to the problem, because, you know, sometimes what helps the Army helps all the DOD.
Right, right. And, or the nation.
Or the nation, yeah, right, yeah. Exactly. You know, so anyway, so that's the clock side. But then the rocks side, right, so you say what's going to pay off. And, you know, I was telling somebody yesterday, if you want to understand the magnetic field in a hunk of basalt, right, mm-hmm. somewhere in England or something like that, right, you can't do that in a lab. You got to go out. The scientist has to go out and study the rock.
That's right.
It's the same thing with what we're doing, you know. This phenomena that we have in the Army on these complex battlefields, you bring the scientists to the complexity and to the commercial innovation, and that's what drives, right, the what you need to invest in. So, you know, getting after these CRCs and what we're doing in the command to start to spell them out will define, as we continue to refine, right, our investments. And, you know, we've scaled back in some things, and we're going to continue to, you know, scale up in those most important areas.
No, I appreciate that, Pat. It's always thought-provoking when we get to have these exchanges and whatnot. I wish we had more time so the audience to hear how we really have these conversations.
Yeah, right, right, right.
But as you reflect on your career, what do you hope your legacy will be, and what impact do you feel you've made on the Army and the broader scientific community? It's like yourself on your back. I know.
Yeah,
that's
you
a
know, I could
question.
Care less about my legacy. So because you and I, you know, are both like that, and I. You know, so I guess I'm not really worried about that. But, you know, I guess in terms of going forward, I mean, what I always used to think is, and I still think, right, you know, what you want is the next person to do a better job than you did, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. You obviously want to do the best job you can, but what you want to do is try to set the best conditions you can for the next person to come in and go even further, you know, go even higher, you know, which really depends on the team. So along your way, you try to set conditions for the team and then roll on. Yeah, because we all take an oath. It's about the oath. It's about the mission.
That's right. That's right.
It's not about us.
One thing I would say, if I had to answer the question just to look, I'd say, well, one is Pat loved the Army. He loved the mission. He loved his people. And he loved ARL and the work that you did. And you considered it to be something that was important for the nation and for the Army. And so from that perspective, I really appreciate, you know, working with you and your commitment. I have to give you one little quick moment, though. Your SLAD days, anything you want to say about something you did at SLAD?
Well, you know, I do. And I guess what I'll say is nobody likes their homework to be graded, right? And but it's very important, as you know from going through school, that you have somebody grading your homework. And so I guess I like to think about, you know, SLAD as sort of those people who sort of give you that independent assessment. And now DAC, you know, does that, and, you know, DAC and TRAC and so forth. You know, so that whole community from SLAD all the way through up can be very important because they allow us to see ourselves in ways that we wouldn't otherwise see ourselves. And that's really important, particularly for a group of people that probably, you know, grew up thinking they're pretty smart because they got good grades. So yeah, I think that's what I say. So let's be careful and not lose that independence.
I agree. So I would say, Dr. Baker, your legacy will undoubtedly continue to inspire the next generation of researchers and leaders. I would say thank you for your service, and we wish you all the best in your next endeavor. You'll probably be like a chief technology officer of some big company, and I'll be calling you saying, hey, Pat, can you help us with blah, 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 blah? And I know you will when the day when I call you.
I'll always help you. I don't know if I'll be a chief technology officer somewhere, but anytime you call, Eric, I'll be there for you.
I appreciate you, brother.
Yeah.
And to our audience, thank you for joining us to learn about DEFCOM Army Research Laboratory and the future of Army research, and to celebrate a remarkable career of service to our nation. Stay tuned for more episodes of DEFCOM's The Cutting Edge podcast, where we will explore the Army's lead role in shaping the global ecosystem of technological innovation and scientific exploration.